The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance tonight. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively. Newcomers, is there anyone in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would like to welcome you. On Zoom, you can raise your hand and someone will chat with you. Do we have anyone in the room tonight in their first 30 days? Hi. Hey, Amanda, welcome. Hi. Nick, hi. Hi, Susan, welcome. Hey, Jack, welcome. Anybody else? Welcome to everyone. All right. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that the book Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism based on simple actions. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism by taking AA's simple actions. AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Normally, the format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. This evening, we have a special speaker, and her name is Lauren, and she's from the Richmond area. So please welcome Lauren.
Hi, I'm Lauren. I'm an alcoholic. It is so nice to be with you guys. I told David, he was like, I'm so excited to hear your story. I'm like, I never miss a free food opportunity. So thank you for everybody for providing the food. And it's just so nice to see some familiar faces. I see a fellow Richmonder, Bruce is here, Kyle's here, Morgan. Nice to see y'all. But you know, even if I don't know you, you know, we know each other. We know each other on a soul level, and that is something I never found anywhere else. You know, when I hear you guys speak about your thinking, about your disease, about the actions you took, you know, that is something that I connect with. And I feel like, you know, I was looking for that all my life and never was able to find it until I walked in these rooms. My sobriety date is December 3rd, 2003. My home group is the Buford Road Group. It meets on Wednesdays at 7. We are a step study as well from the Big Book. And I have a sponsor who's aware that she's my sponsor. I talked to her yesterday. And I do sponsor women. And I'm available to sponsor. I'm a little bit in my head right now because I asked God to speak through me because I don't want to hear what I have to say and y'all don't either. So I'm asking God to use me as a vessel. But I'm a little bit preoccupied because this is the longest I've left my babies at home. And I have a 12-week-old and a 19-month-old. And so they're with my husband right now. And so y'all might want to keep him in your prayers too. But, two girls. But yeah, I mean, that I'll tell you about what it was like. But, you know, this leads me into thinking about what a life God has given me today. I mean, My youngest has just discovered her hands, and my oldest has just discovered the word no. And, you know, and they are everything to me. And when I started dating my husband, I told him right away, I don't want children. I never want them. And you're not going to change my mind. So you need to leave if that's something that you want. And when I turned 40, I was like, I think I changed my mind. I waited a little bit to make sure it wasn't some like fancy whim, because you know how we get those. And, you know, it's just been the greatest gift. And I think it's the biggest lesson in unselfishness and what a selfish, self-centered person I am to my core. I am all I think about. What are you thinking of me? I told my friend Jake, thank you for coming with me. I told my friend Jake, because he was talking about, you know, when I come in a room, hi, everybody. And I greet everybody. And I said, do you know why that is? I said, it's so I won't feel afraid of you. It's so I can level the playing field. It's not because that's who I am, because I am a person riddled with social anxiety, you know, but I need that connection, you know, that we get here. And that's what I crave. And so, you know, I can remember from an early age, I grew up in Richmond, from an early age, watching the kids on the playground and they were playing with each other and just thinking, how do they do that? And what are they talking about? And can I get close enough to where I can figure out what they're saying so that maybe I can figure out how to have a friend too? I just couldn't figure out, you know, like the big book talks about, everybody else had gotten this manual and I just was ill-equipped. And I found from an early age ways of escaping myself, ways of getting out of my head, of getting out of how I felt. Of course, I didn't have the words or the knowledge to identify that at the time, but I started doing things like attention seeking, getting into trouble. I was somebody who got detention a lot. You know, the teacher doesn't like it when you look her up in the phone book and call her and make threats to her on her answering machine. I mean, that is not good, you know? And snorting pixie sticks. That was something that I didn't take. You feel me? Yeah. Okay. Pixie sticks and Tang, you know, listening to anything that I can do. You know, I was one of those kids. Do you remember, you know, you do that thing where you cross your arms and you squat on the ground and you hyperventilate, you breathe really quickly, and then you stand up and don't do this if you haven't. And you stand up really quickly, it kills more brain cells than y'all have already lost. But you stand up really quickly and someone pushes on your chest and then you faint. Well, I was one of those people who did that again and again and again, and I just couldn't get enough of it. I heard somebody talking about the other day that they were the kid that would spin around and around in circles on the playground. That was me too, you know, to feel dizzy. Anything to feel how different than how I was feeling. I later on got into, I was really into Rage Against the Machine and Nine Inch Nails, because I liked that dark place that I could go when I was listening to that music. I was into Cutting. I was into some really dark poetry. But, you know, to back up a little bit, in sixth grade, I remember, you know, I was already living this double life, because I'm coming to school with a backpack full of clothes that I'm not allowed to wear to school. And I'm changing into those in the bathroom and then changing again to go home. And then I had pierced myself. I had pierced my ears all the way up and down. And I would take that out to go to youth group or gymnastics or whatever, because I'm whatever you want me to be as long as I can be accepted. So, you know, I'm that chameleon. So if I go to school, I really want to fit in with the people who are super rebellious. And I feel like I can't, you know, I can't quite be enough, because everywhere I go, I'm not quite enough. That's how I feel, you know, that I'm not enough. So I can't quite make it, but I'm trying to get there in all these places. So I'm this person, you know, with the pierced ears and the, you know, clothing I'm not supposed to wear. And then, you know, I go and I, you know, I'm this gymnast, and then I go over here and I'm at youth group and doing this. And I'll say to you, there was something, I felt very uncomfortable in church. And it was because I always felt it's that thing that we talk about in the big book, that every man, woman, and child is born with this fundamental sense of a higher power on the inside. And when I went to church, that tapped into that. And I was uncomfortable with that sort of vulnerability, but that planted that seed, and it wakened me just enough to know that there was something out there greater than me. And later I would plead to, you know, when I was, you know, not wanting to live anymore. So all of these things that I tell you about getting out of myself, wanting to escape, they all did fine and good temporarily, but they didn't really do what I wanted. You know, they missed the mark. They didn't really, hi ladies, welcome. Good to see you. So I first found, before I took my first drink, I was smoking everything under the sun, cigarettes, paper, whatever. There was also like anything you could catch on fire, but there was also this thing called the Anarchist Cookbook. And in the Anarchist Cookbook, I see some people nodding, you can learn how to make bombs and drugs. And so I learned how to make drugs out of banana peels. And again, don't do that. That doesn't work either. But I tried it. And I taught, when I later went to rehab, I taught everybody in rehab how to do that too. That was fun. But I've since picked up a white chip, but you know. But anyway, so, you know, I'm doing all this stuff. I'm just running around trying to put anything in my body. Then, you know, I'm 16 years old. I don't know when I took my first drink. I had sips of beer here and there. My family is originally from Maryland, so we crack crabs on the table with the newspaper and beer, you know, PBR. And so I'm taking little sips of the grandparents' beer here and there. But, you know, I had my first drunk at 16, and it was with a bunch of girls. We're at somebody's house for a sleepover, which was perfect because we're all going to get obliterated. We set out to do that. And we're drinking Fuzzy Navels and Zima. And that's what we chose. And you know, and we had bagels too, because somebody told us we're not supposed to drink on an empty stomach. So, you know, we want to be okay, you know, so we want to do it right. So, you know, alcohol did something for me that night that I had never before experienced. I had a spiritual awakening at that moment. You know, I finally felt like I fit in somewhere. I finally found like I had some common ground. I finally felt like I was good enough, that I was seen. You know, I was funny. I was smart. It was my magic elixir, my magic potion. And man, you know, I didn't have the feeling, you know, that I immediately, you know, wanted to do it again or anything like that, because I was very sick the next morning, and that put enough fear in me to wait a little bit. But what I intuitively knew or felt was that I can't do this again until I can get enough. And I knew I wasn't the type of girl right away. I knew I wasn't the type of girl that could sit and have one or two and be okay. I wanted to just go away and have enough. And there was this commercial that was playing around that time. And it was around the same time of, this is your brain, this is your brain on drugs, any questions? Well, there was this other commercial that wasn't as frequently played, but it was this man, and he was dancing around, he's kind of spinning in a circle. And there were all these colors streaming from him. And there was some music that was kind of muffled playing in the background. And if I had words to describe what that image looked like, I would say oblivion. And the narrator came on and he said, you know, nobody ever said I want to be a junkie when I grow up. And I looked at that screen and I looked how I imagined that man was feeling. And I thought, that's exactly what I want to be. And that's exactly how I want to feel. I got a fake ID at 17. I used it. But what happened, I used it. What happened, let me back up just a bit, but, you know, so I was raised by a single mother, And she gave us everything that we needed and lots of, most of what we wanted. I was raised in an area where I went to this thing called cotillion, which is like ballroom dancing with the white gloves. So my point in telling you that was I was raised to be a lady. You know, that is not how I ended up, but I was not raised in a way conducive to the behavior that I was participating in later in life. But I was set up with everything. You know, I was given all the tools to succeed. And, my father is a self-proclaimed alcoholic. He has not gotten sober, but maybe one day he will. But we were kind of estranged growing up. My parents got divorced when I was 3. So, here I am, I'm 16. I have this incredible drunk, sick the next morning. It's fine. I can't do this again until I can get everything that I want. So I'm putting other things in my body at that point. Because my mom was like a private eye or something, because she found me out everything I did. She always knew what I was up to. It was a lot of like sneaking out, spray painting, like lots of stuff like that, tipping over mailboxes, just, you know, that took me out of myself too. But I got into college, surprisingly, and I got into this college called Longwood College. And I call it Shortwood because I only lasted a semester before I got kicked out. I had a 0.78 GPA, and I really think I had to like try at being that terrible. But I just honestly think something else that goes along with my disease is like, I'm entitled. So I feel like you should just give me things without me having to work to earn them. So for some reason, I thought I was magically going to get grades, good grades, and going to be able to stay there. So I didn't go to class, prior to that, so I'm getting ready to leave for college. I know I'm jumping around a little bit. I have major mom brain, y'all. So just please bear with me. So sleep deprivation, so I'm getting ready to go to college and, it's looking like, we're not really getting the funds that we need. And it's looking like maybe I won't be able to go. And so I go in the medicine cabinet and take all the pills in the medicine cabinet and end up in the ER. And, I was conscious the whole time. So I ended up getting my stomach pumped, and they couldn't get the tube down my nose, so they put it down my throat. And in the interim, it caused a big, massive nosebleed. So when my mom showed up, all she saw was this blood covering me everywhere. And as a mother, I can't imagine how scary that is. But, my goal in doing that was not because I wanted to kill myself. It was because I needed to do what I needed to do to get my drink. And the way I knew I needed to get my drink and drink the way I wanted to drink and look like that man on that screen was to go to college and to get away from my mom and to be able to drink like I wanted to. So I did what I needed to at any cost. I do not care what you think or how you feel. I need what I need. So this is what I do. That's just who I am. So immediately when I get to college, I'm already in trouble with the police for swimming in the fountain naked, because something that I like to do when I'm drunk too is get naked. And I don't know if y'all are like that, but I'm so at my core, I'm so ashamed of myself too. So when I'm drinking, it lowers my inhibitions and it gives me this sense of freedom. So I take that to an extreme. But so I'm in trouble with the police, I'm blacking out. And the thing that I found when I woke up from blackouts in the morning, wherever I was, and when people were telling me, do you remember you did this last night? And I can't believe this is what happened. This is what you did. And what I felt from that is not a sense of disappointment or later where I would feel the incomprehensible demoralization, but I felt a sense of belonging because you all were talking to me and I felt like you were accepting me for what I was doing. Also around that time, because of my drinking, I put myself in a situation where I should have gone to the police. But because I knew that if I went to police, that I would not be able to drink at that fraternity anymore. I didn't do anything. And I continued to drink at that fraternity the way I wanted to. Got a nice little letter on Christmas vacation saying that I wasn't welcome back by the dean. That was fine because I had my fake ID, moved back home with mom. you know, I started, I was drinking the same way I was drinking there. And I started getting what I call the look. You know, I have a younger brother and he was giving me the look too. So like when I'm crawling home in the morning, I see the look on their faces and it just hurts so bad because what I'm seeing is in the look is I'm seeing myself the way that they're seeing me. And it's too painful and uncomfortable for me to be around that. So I take a geographic and I move to Nag's Head, and that's in North, y'all know I'm not in like across the US, about to tell you where that is. So around the time I go to Nag's Head, I find what a friend of mine calls alcohol enhancers. So I found some things to do which could allow me to stay up for days at a time and drink the way I wanted to. I did little tricks like, you know, okay, well, I think I'm feeling sick, so I'll just make myself throw up and do a little bit of that other stuff, and then I'm good to go for another, you know, while, and I'm good. Something else that is a part of my story is that I need validation from you so bad. So the way that I like to get that is through acting out on sexual behavior too. And let me tell you, people don't like it when you sleep with their boyfriends either. And I was doing a lot of that in Nag's Head, and it's a small town. And I was just not welcome. I was pretty much kicked out of there the way that I was kicked out of college. Although they didn't give me a nice letter. They peed in my bed. I came home one day from from whatever I was doing. And I feel like peeing in somebody's bed is like the equivalent of egging your house. Like if somebody rolls your house, they really like you and they like have a crush on you. If they egg your house, they don't like you. Like they like egged my bed by peeing in it. They were like, we do not want you here. So I lasted there for probably like 2.5 months. But I did some of my best drinking there, and Nag's had definitely accelerated me to my bottom. I have to tell you, I was also dating this guy off and on who lived about 1.5 hours north from me in Northern Virginia, which was perfect for a drunk like me because I can continue to live a double life because he doesn't know what I'm doing in Richmond on my off days. But, you know, then I can be somebody else when I'm with him. And so, you know, I come back from Nag's Head and we pick back up where we left off. And I decide that we need to get married because, you know, maybe I'm starting to feel the consequences of my drinking at that point. And I'm not talking, you know, getting locked up in prison or anything like that, but I'm talking about the feeling that we feel on the inside where we feel that gross and incomprehensible demoralization, where we feel like a piece of crap, where we feel worthless, where we feel so much shame. And shame is a big part of my story too, is that when I got here, I had so much of that. I didn't feel that I was worthy of you people. But I'm feeling that. So I think that we need to get married because maybe if I get the husband, maybe if I get the house, maybe if I get the right things on the outside, then I won't feel so bad on the inside. So, you know, also around that time, people are starting to talk to me about my drinking. At one point, we had some sort of like intervention where it was like my therapist involved and my family members, and I signed a contract. And, you know, I really wanted to be good. I really wanted to be a good girl. And I signed this contract. And the contract, I agreed to only drink 2 beers and no liquor. And so I signed that contract, and the next day I was in the hospital with alcohol poisoning. I mean, that's how I am. Like I cannot pull it off left to my own devices. I can't stop or moderate, you know. Welcome. Good to see you. I cannot stop or moderate, you know? And, so, you know, I've got this hostage fiance now. You know, I've convinced him to marry me. And I will tell you, I was telling Amy on the phone, the other night that I'm a person also who is like, you know, the A's, B's and C's. I'm like, maybe human power can fix me. And here's how. So in sobriety, I've been engaged 7 times to men and women, because I think that's going to fix me, because I'm a sometimes slowly variety. Kyle's seen it. It's a mess, y'all. It's a mess. So my sponsee yesterday was like, I can't picture you being drunk and being a mess. Were you the one who told me about how you just didn't open your mail? You would throw it away. And I'm like, yeah, just throw it away. Then you don't have to deal with it. And, just see how that happens. So I'm like, let me send you a picture, because I have one in my big book. I will send you a photo of when I think that I'm looking really good and like in my cups. And I sent her this picture and she was like, thank you. No. And now she's being honest with me about what's really going on with her. So pictures worth 1,000 words. So I'm really starting to feel really bad, you know, when it's starting to catch up with me. And so I think maybe I'll check out AA, and thank God for Intergroup, because I looked up, it was like 3 a.m. I looked up Alcoholics Anonymous in the phone book, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the Intergroup line. And somebody is there, you know, somebody is there 24 hours a day picking up that phone. Somebody picked up the phone for me and they told me where to find my first meeting. And I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous because of my father, because he had been in and out, you know, ever since I was really little. So I went to this Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I walked in, and what I felt was a sense of you guys were welcoming me, and I wasn't welcome in a whole lot of places at that time. And I just loved you. I fell in love with you. However, I had not reached my bottom. So what I did was, I took a look at the steps on the wall. It was like, I got all those, went straight to step 9. Because of doing that unsupervised without a higher power, I ended up in another engagement. So that's me left to my own devices. Like that's what happens. And, you know, all the while I'm doing these outside issues, like I'm doing these other things on the side, these alcohol enhancers, but I don't really have my real solution. So I'm coming out of my skin, and I'm going to describe to you how I feel when I'm without a drink and without a solution. I feel like my skin is crawling. I want to climb the walls. I want to scratch my skin off. Just like everything is screaming on the inside. And I feel like I need to either like harm myself on the outside or scream loud enough so I can drown that out. But the alcohol is what fixes that. So I'm like doing this other stuff for 11 months, picking up chips. That's not sober, but I didn't have a sponsor who told me, you know, who I was listening to that would tell me that, was not following any suggestions, and ended up drinking again. I had to, you know, y'all, that is my solution. You know, alcohol wasn't my problem. It was my solution until I got here. At that point, I'm playing these little games with myself. I'm like, I have these things that I call liaries now. So I had 3 different notebooks. I had like one for my employer, one for my friends, and one for my family. And I would write my lies. I know it's like super control freak, but it's, I thought that if I could write down my lies and keep them organized, then I could fool y'all. And maybe I wasn't an alcoholic, because if I can keep everything straight, I'm not an alcoholic. And also I can't, you know, it's getting harder and harder to pick up the phone, because when I'm picking up the phone, if somebody else is in the room, I can't remember if this is going to match up. If this person is hearing what I told him, and what are you hearing over here? And is this in alignment? You know, that's getting harder and harder. I don't know where I can go at this point, because I don't know what places, I can't remember what places I've been kicked out of. I can't go to the grocery store because I can't remember what I've done to you the night before. So I don't know if I'm going to bump into you. So my world became smaller and smaller. And around that time too, I began to experience DTs, and I just thought I was having low blood sugar. And, you know, I would just, you know, hang out, go to the Waffle House, and get all jacked up on sugar and until I could go to the bar again. And it continued in that cycle. So it's like, okay, I'm only going to have this many drinks. Okay, well, I've already passed that mark, so I might as well just have some more. Okay, F it. Let's just do it. And then we'll get sober tomorrow. But for now, write your lies on the BevNap, stash them in your pocket, transfer them into the liary so you can keep it straight, because you got to maintain some order. You got to maintain that. And then, you know, I wake up, I don't know where I am. I don't know who I'm with. And I feel that sense of shame. Maybe I can get out of here before I wake anybody up. Then it won't be reality. It won't be real if y'all are still sleeping when I leave, because then nobody will see me. And I'll just go and I'll find my car and I'll go home. I'm never going to do that again. And then some time passes and maybe it wasn't that bad. And, you know, there's this one time, you know, in talking about, I don't know where I'm going to wake up. There's this one time where I was, I had a period where I was trying to fool myself by dressing in fancy bars and drinking top shelf liquor. And maybe if I do that, I'm not an alcoholic. So, you know, I'm drinking like my sapphire dirty martinis. And, at the end, I like to drink Bowman's vodka because it's got the plastic bottle and you can fall down a lot and it won't break. But, this is in my period of like, I'm going to be fancy. So I'm like stealing from my job. I'm stealing from the register and I'm buying some like clothes that I think are fancy. And I'm going to these fancy bars and drinking my fancy drinks with these fancy people. And this one time this guy offered me money to go home with him. And I was like, how dare you? I cannot believe that you would talk to me like that. Meanwhile, you know, fast forward, I'm going home with somebody else for free later on that night. It's like, you know, I get some drinks in me and all bets are off. I don't know what is going to happen, but I can have moral and philosophical convictions galore, you know, at the start of the night. But once I put my drink in my body, I'm absolutely powerless over that. It activates an allergy. It activates a craving beyond my mental control. And I, you know, I told you about all the tricks I was doing to try and fix that. So around this time, I'm living back with my mom. And I also, when I had been coming to those Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, I identified out really quickly because I wasn't as bad as you. And it's funny because the longer I stay sober, the worse my drinking gets. You know, I'm like, oh my, because it's like that onion. I start to remember stuff that I did. I'm like, wow. But, you know, I had never lost anything. I had never been to jail. I had never gotten a DUI. I'd had run-ins with the cops a couple times, but I never got arrested. And so I wasn't as bad as you. You know, I don't belong here. That kind of thing. But the thing is, I had never worked to earn any money to, you know, I was spending money on drinks. So I was never buying, I never bought a car. I never bought, you know, paid for rent or a place to live. I never worked to earn anything to buy my own stuff. I was just mooching off of my mom. So anything I had to lose was borrowed stuff, you know, it wasn't mine. And that's all stuff. What I wasn't paying attention to here was when you were talking about how you felt and how you thought, you know, the process and the thinking that precedes the drink, the obsession of the mind, and then the compulsion of the body that happens once we put a drink in it. How am I doing on time, David?
You're good.
Okay. Around this time, my mom getting the look, crawling home, DTs, that whole stuff, you know, and she gives me the best gift I could have been given. And she says, you know, you either get help or you get out. And I had no place to go. And so she offered to take me to detox, which is called Tucker's at Chippenham Hospital. And so I went to Tucker's for 5 days, but because, you know, I needed to try and retain some sort of dignity to my thinking was, you know, I needed to control the situation. So what I did, I put conditions on it. So I'm like, I'm only going if I can take my makeup and my this and my that, because maybe I'll, like, my thinking is maybe I'll find him in the detox. Like, you never know where he's going to show up. You just never know. And that's the other thing too. I really thought that if I was in the right place at the right time, sitting on the right bar stool, that he was just going to show up and save me. And then I would feel better. And all my problems would go away. Just save me from myself. And I did, like, I don't know about y'all, but I did kind of attract, like, the fixers, you know, and they'd cry about my drinking and they'd really want to fix me and help me and stuff. And then I just ended up thinking that that was pathetic. So I just left it anyway. So, so that doesn't work for me, but, so she gives me an ultimatum. I want to take my makeup. I might find him in there. Let's see. You know, and so from the detox, spending 5 days in the detox, from there, I went to treatment, and, my mom paid for that. And, in sobriety, I paid her back for that, as a part of my amends. But, you know, in that treatment facility, we were taken to outside meetings. And in one of these meetings, you know, I was having a difficult time. I could see how I was powerless over alcohol, but I was having a difficult time with seeing how my life was unmanageable. And I was going to, I pulled out my wallet and I was going to contribute to the Seventh Tradition basket one day. And it wasn't because I wanted to be altruistic or any of that, selfless. It was really because I, like, maybe you're looking at me and I want you to see that I'm putting this money in the basket and maybe you can be a prospect later. So I go into my wallet. I love you, David. This is being recorded. Okay. All right. So I go in my wallet, and in my wallet, I find doctor's notes. I find forged doctor's notes. I find the BevNat naps that I had scribbled my lies onto with the intention of transferring into my liaries. And in that moment, God made me really aware of how my life was unmanageable. And it was at that moment that I fully surrendered to this program. I always had sponsorship. Strong sponsorship in that, my definition of that is somebody who takes the steps out of the big book. So my first sponsor had me write my, my first step on a piece of paper in columns so I could see on black and white how I was powerless and how my life was unmanageable. And that was really eye-opening to me to see that, because you can't get away from that, you know. I was having a bit of a time with how you people were talking about God, because I saw you laughing and I saw the way that you looked, and, you know, I didn't feel anything like how you looked. And I heard, you know, that there was this God that was all loving and compassionate and kind and accepting. And I thought that there wasn't anything that God would have anything to do with me, because the things that I had done when I was drinking, I couldn't possibly be worthy of that kind of love. And so my first higher power was really group of drunks. It was the fellowship. And when I hold your hand during the Lord's Prayer, and feel that surge of energy, it's undeniable that there's a presence greater than us. You know, it's palpable. I can feel it. It kind of evolved into good orderly direction. My sponsor, I trusted that she had stayed sober and that she was a different person. I heard how she had talked about where she had been and what she had done and who she was. And I knew that she was different, that she was changed, because I would watch her. You know, because I'm a watcher. I'm watching what you're doing. And so then eventually it evolved into the higher power that I call God today. But my God can be, you know, my God is the ocean. My God is nature. My God is animals, you know, my God can be anywhere. And I don't know where he or she is going to show up, but I am open and ready and available to receive the message. And that is something that you people taught me. I took the third step on my knees with my sponsor, which was really uncomfortable because I had never had a relationship that was as vulnerable as I had with my sponsor. And what we did was we got on our knees and held hands and said the third step prayer together. And in that space, you know, we're asking God to enter into that space and to change us and to ask him to free us from the bondage of self, you know. And that prepared me to get busy on my four step. I wasn't afraid of the four step because I heard you all talking about it and, you know, some of the difficulties that you had with it. And so I wanted to, you know, be a straight A gold star student and get it done. And so I, you know, I really had no problem with writing 60 pages of how angry I was at you. I had, you know, 60 pages of resentment. And, you know, I had my conduct on there. And what gave me permission to share my conduct with another woman was the same way that I had been given permission to accept this higher power's love and understanding, is that somebody who came before me shared their experience with me. She pulled out her four step and she allowed me to open to any page I wanted and read it. And I do that for my sponsees today too, you know, because how can I ask them to share their dark with me if I'm not willing to share mine with you? That's all it's about, is sharing our experience, strength, and hope. And what have I got if I'm not got that? So she shared that with me and allowed me to be honest about my conduct and my fears and my fears. I really got here. I showed up on your door thinking I had no fears because I'm not afraid of spiders. I'm not afraid of snakes. I'm not afraid of heights or flying or any of that. But what I wasn't able to see was that I'm afraid of everything. You know, I'm afraid of commitment, but I'm afraid of being alone. You know, I'm afraid of what you're going to think of me, but I'm afraid of getting close to you. You know, my biggest fear is intimacy because I'm afraid you're going to abandon me. I can't really let you see who I really am because if you do, then you're going to leave me and I'll be alone. So I keep you right here. You know, that's safe. And that's how I had lived my life. But I got honest on my four step with my fears. And what happened was in leaving her house, I didn't have any sort of like bright white experience or anything like that. But what I had was more of the educational variety, in that I had just shared all of who I was and what I had done with another human being, another woman, and I had never trusted another woman, and I had never had an honest relationship with anybody. And I had shared all those things, and I came away from that, and I had no thought of drinking. I have no idea what did that other than a higher power. You know, that is not me. Because I told you I had secrets galore. You know, it's just a miracle. It's just such a gift that we can take inventory like that, you know. You know, it took me a long time to really honestly do a sixth and seventh step. And I paid a price for that. There were a lot of character defects that I was really holding onto very tightly. You know, for a long time in sobriety, I really still needed validation, thought that I needed validation from you, and was really seeking that because I was scared of really fully surrendering everything of me to my higher power, because I still was having a little bit of reservation about letting him come into every aspect. I felt that Amy and I were talking about this. I felt that maybe I had to show up on God's door being better, or being, you know, being clean, being good, being wholesome, you know. And that's not the case at all. You know, he takes our broken, you know, and he stays with us no matter what. He or she, my mother-in-law is calling me. Bye. So Speaking of character defects, God give me the strength. I love my mother-in-law. I do. And that's, you know, that's as a result of this program, you know, that I can show up for that relationship. But, and I call her to see how she's doing. So about 10 years sober, I started living a double life in sobriety. And this is where I'm talking about my character defects and hanging on to them. So I started living a double life in sobriety. And let me tell you, what I was hearing, this is not what y'all are saying, but what I was hearing was a lot of happy ever after from the podium. And that wasn't what I was experiencing. So I thought that there was something wrong with me. So when I was entering into this really dark time, I was afraid to share it with you. I was being honest with my sponsor about it, which I know is what saved my life, because it had long passed, you know, the drink option that had long since passed, but I really wanted to die. And the thing that saved me, honestly, is service work. I was treasurer of Intergroup at that time. And I remember having a conscious thought, I can't kill myself now because what are you going to think of me? You know? And I shared that at the end of my treasury position. It's a two-year commitment. So it's a long time, you know, to delay that. But at the end of that, I shared, I'm like, well, I wanted to kill myself. And then I was treasurer and now I don't. And I thought we would do like what y'all did, which was all share, like, you know, a laugh and everything. And everybody looked at me with like these morbid expressions. And I'm like, sorry, but you know, oops. But you know, so I really had to go back and do a thorough 6 and 7 step and really look at what I was hanging on to and why. You know, I thought it was self-preservation. And I thought, honestly, what it really was, if I get down to it, is I'm not going to get what I want. I'm not going to get what I want. And what's at the bottom of that is I'm not going to be safe. And what's at the bottom of that is you're going to abandon me. What's at the bottom of that is I'm going to be alone. The first time, you know, I made an 8-step list, you know, thank God I did it with a sponsor, because she let me know when it would harm somebody else to go make a direct amend. So I did not end up with another engagement that time. So, you know, I made direct amends wherever possible. I waited 12 years to make amends to my father. I do not recommend that, but that one was one that I refused to make, because to me, I had a justifiable resentment. And I sat on that for 12 years, and I had this dream one night. And in the dream, it was the days of answering machines. And in the dream, my dad was leaving a message on my answering machine. And in his voice, I just heard this brokenness. And the way that I felt when I woke up from that dream was I felt compassion, and I felt sorry for him when I woke up. And that that I believe was God, because that was not me. And I made amends to him. I had 12 years sober. He met me halfway in between my house and his house. And it was 11 o'clock in the morning, and he had postponed his drink. So when he showed up, he was in DTs. And, you know, he lasted about a half an hour, and then he threw some money at me, and then we parted ways. But you know what? He did the best that he could. That was how he showed up. He did everything he could. He postponed, an alcoholic postponed his drink, you know, to have a meeting with his daughter. And I think that is it. You know, I look at that as a gift. You know, I know that he loves me today. And I have a relationship with him with boundaries. You know, I do also, I have also treated, you know, the Al-Anon side of me. You know, some other amends that I've made, you know, the first amend that I made was to an old employer, because when I'm done with a job, I don't give you 2 weeks or anything. I just leave, you know, and then I turn off my phone, and then I just avoid. And so I did that with a Starbucks, and I went back and made amends to the manager there, and she offered me my job back. I mean, that was how my first amend went. And, you know, I was like, oh, great. This is a great process. All of these are going to be great. And, you know, there were some people that told me never to contact them again. You know, the man that I told you, the first engagement I had, I was in a restaurant eating dinner with my now ex-husband. And that, I know it's going to be hard to keep them straight. So the old one came in and went to the bar and I saw him and he didn't see me. And I quietly asked the waiter to come over and box our food to go because, you know, he does not need to see me. And I do not cause enough damage in his life. And my amend to him is to leave him alone. You know, I have a living amends that I make today to my family. You know, I made direct amends to them also, but, you know, another thing is that I didn't realize that I owed an amend to a childhood dog. I'm a big dog lover, big animal lover. And I've been volunteering at our local animal shelter for 10 years. That's my second longest relationship next to you guys to date. But I realized, you know, as I was doing this service work and you know, I'm bringing the principles and the traditions of AA into that space, you know, I'm only able to be there as a result of being sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. But, you know, I'm realizing that I'm making an amend to my childhood dog, you know, there. She had cancer and we had to remove part of her jaw and it was very foul smelling. And I didn't want to tell her goodbye because I didn't want her smell to get on my clothing. And, but one of the dogs that I have now, I have two dogs now, and one of the dogs, I know it's her and him. The 10th step for me is that's the hardest one right now for me. I'm really good at cleaning up my side of the street when it's you people, but in my home, like I have this really huge need right now to be right. And I really want to tell you about how I'm right, you know, and it's just, you know, my friend Eric talks about I had to get wrong. And there are a lot of times where I just have to eat crow and just get wrong with my husband. And that's a very humbling experience because I'm always right, you know. And no, but seriously, it's you know, I today I like to think, you know, most of the time, if I have something going on, you know, a selfish thought, you know, dishonesty creeping up, some fear, I call somebody and talk about it with them. And then, you know, and then if I owe an amend, I make that. And then I turn outward. I call a sponsee, I call somebody else and I ask them how they're doing. And my prayer and meditation life could always be better, but it's always evolving as my spiritual life does. Today, it's been a little bit difficult to get some time to some organized, structured time to do prayer and meditation with the way my life looks. But the way that I found it is I've just found little ways of carving that out. And my daughters and I say good morning to nature in the morning. And we say good morning trees and good morning birds, good morning grass, good morning sky, good morning God, you know, good morning dogs, good morning all you people of the world. Sort of like good night moon, but backwards, which we love good night moon. And so we do that. And that's my offering, you know, that's my living gratitude. That's my prayer, you know, and I try and live my life as like a walking prayer. And the way that I try and do that is to live my life in a way of gratitude. And the way I do that is to try and be of service everywhere I can. One day I was taking a walk before I had kids with my dogs, and I was walking by myself with them, and I just heard my footsteps in the snow. There was snow on the ground, and it was just psh, 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 in the snow. And I started thinking, thank you, thank you, thank you, with each step I was taking. And that was my offering to God, was a thank you, thank you, thank you for each step I'm taking, and that I can be fully present today. It is an honor to walk people through the steps, to take people through the book today, you know, to give them the steps the way that I was taken through them, and to watch people change. You know, I have a friend who reached out to me 3 years ago. I'm friends with her mom, and she is the daughter, who is my friend, is an alcoholic, as she says. And she's been reaching out to me. She texts me and calls me all day long, every day for 3 years, and has been drunk for 3 years. And AA doesn't work for me. You know, that's what she says. And all I can do for her is be an example of this way of life. I cannot tell her what's on the other side of this deal. I cannot give it to her. I can't give her the gift of desperation. I can't let her see that when you take these steps in order, you know, there's a life. Been rocketed into the fourth dimension. You know, there is a life beyond your wildest dreams. I never, you know, the life that I live today was not at all what I had planned. And thank God for that. You know, my life today looks like, you know, I've got my two little girls, my husband, who's also in this program. I have my dream job. I'm a published writer. I have a story. I have a book signing next month. I have a story in the most recent Chicken Soup for the Soul book. And I've told the story of that dog that I told you about in my writing, in the published pieces. And this most recent one is about one of the dogs I have now. But, you know, the dogs in the shelter that I help, I think they live, they get two lives and one existence, just like we do, you know. God spelled backwards is dog. That's really where I see that compassion. Yeah. It's really where I see that compassion and unconditional love is there. You know, I have, like I said, I got my dream job, published writer, have, you know, pay my bills without throwing them away. You know, marriage is hard, but, you know, I'm not running today, you know. I'm there and I'm doing the work, and that's the first time I've ever done the work. You know, what else can I tell you? It's a good life. And if you stick here long enough, then I hope then you can experience what I've experienced. And thank you so much for having me.
Let's give her another round of applause. Thank you so much, Lauren. And you'll have a chance to come up and thank her afterwards. Now we're going to pass the seventh tradition basket. We also have a QR code for PayPal and Venmo. Let's see. You can sign up for email on our website at simpleactions.net. Like I said, we have PayPal and Venmo. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting space for all attendees and encourage each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meetings can take place.
Okay, great.
Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, raise your hands. Woo-hoo. All right. Sponsorship. Sponsorship is And AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here after we close the meeting. Please feel free to talk to any of us, or you can email us at info@simpleactions.net. We do have literature available over here at the hand sanitizing station. Feel free, we have some newcomer packets if you need one of those. A reminder, smokers, please use the butt can provided outside and stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. Are we doing the meeting after the meeting?
No.
No. Okay. Normally we go to dinner after the meeting, so come back next week and we'll go to dinner. Okay. And then again, I'd like to thank Lauren for speaking. And I'd like to thank everyone who brought the delicious food. And then we're going to get circle up and close with the Lord's Prayer. And I totally skipped this. Thanks for reading. All right. And whose Father?
Our Father.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. And forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Amen.
Yay!
Thank you.
Thank you.